It is Friday, May 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, debris from the missing Egypt airplane is found in the Mediterranean. Taiwan inaugurates a new president, and country music mourns the loss of Guy Clark. It's all ahead. Egypt says it has found debris from the downed Egypt Air Flight 804 in the Mediterranean Sea. Egyptian Army Brigadier General Mohamed Samer Said issued a statement on Facebook Friday saying personal belongings of the passengers and parts of the plane debris were found floating in the water. In Athens, Greek officials said that a body part, seat, and suitcases had been discovered by Egyptian authorities a short distance south of where the aircraft vanished from radar screens. Search teams continue scouring the Mediterranean, looking for the wreckage of the Egypt air jet that carried 66 people. It disappeared from radar north of the Egyptian coast and crashed into the sea Thursday on a flight from Paris to Cairo. No cause of the crash has been determined. Saijun Gohel is International Security Director of the London-based Asia-Pacific Foundation. I asked him about the possibility that the downing of the plane could have been caused by terrorism.
We know that something terrible happened to this plane. As to whether it was accidental, catastrophic, or with deliberate malicious intent, that remains to be seen. We know that terrorists are obsessed in targeting the aviation industry. Both the Al-Qaeda and ISIS affiliates have often spoken about targeting planes. The other factor that is important is the historical significance of this week. This week marks the 100-year anniversary of the Sykes-Picot Agreement between Britain and France, where they agreed to carve up the Ottoman Empire in the aftermath of World War I, which has been cited by terrorist groups like ISIS as a historical grievance. So authorities were already worried this week that a potential attack could happen. And the fact that something has happened this week only adds to more speculation. This could be terrorism, but we need to wait and see.
And what about security at the other airports where this plane landed? I mean, say, for instance, Charles de Gaulle in Paris. I believe security there is very tight, and which would include people that, say, you know, work for the airline there.
Well, this is a very important angle because the plane left Paris's Charles de Gaulle Airport, where there is very tight security, especially in the aftermath of the Paris attacks last year. There is an improvement in surveillance and monitoring, in checking people. And the French authorities themselves had removed the credentials of many people working airside since the Paris attacks to improve their own security. If this is a terrorist attack, it is a game changer in terms of how we travel in the future, because it would mean that there was a problem at the Paris end, which would then mean that there's going to have to be reevaluation as to security procedures, and that will have a knock-on effect worldwide.
And also, you know, again, this, we still need to get more information about this, but this comes fairly soon after recent attacks in Brussels and, of course, Paris. You know, it must be, I would think, extremely nerve-wracking for people wanting to travel throughout Europe or going from Europe to the Middle East.
Well, I'm afraid that with any type of terrorism, the first goal is always to kill and maim people, but the secondary goal, which is easier to achieve, is to cause disruption and to instill fear in people's minds. The Eurostar, which has been such an important artery linking several European countries, has had a huge reduction in the number of people going to use its services because they're scared of terrorism. And there will be the same knock-on effect when it comes to aviation travel in the aftermath of what has taken place with the Egypt air flight. Whether it's terrorism or not, the point is there will be fear.
Saijun Gohel, International Security Director of the Asia-Pacific Foundation in London. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, a lot of the things that we're seeing on social media are things that John touched on, the mystery of why this happened, a lot of questions about that, and also a lot of concern over security. We're also in a kind of bizarre way, seeing a U.S. political angle, because Donald Trump tweeted out and said that this was a terrorist attack. Hillary Clinton has come out and said it's a terrorist attack. And so there's a lot of debate over that, whether they should have come out without all of the information being known by investigators right now and come out and say, oh, we believe this was a terrorist attack. So they're getting criticized for that even. But we're also seeing, you know, condolences, and it's really the kind of sad pattern that we see when events like this happen. It starts out with the questions, and then as the answers come in, the fears and also the sadness over the loss of life. So we're seeing that play out as we speak on social media. And also we have trending today in a lighter story or happier story, Bike to Work Day here in the United States. So this is the day every year where they say, don't take your car into work, take a bike instead, in order to be more environmentally friendly, to promote exercise. So we're seeing lots of photos of people biking to work. And of course, in the age that we live in, everybody has a smartphone and GoPro cameras. So we're seeing some really creative video on social media, people doing time-lapse videos of their trips into work on their bikes, where they're doing helmet videos where we see from their perspective what it looks like to ride into work. And we're seeing a whole bunch of celebrities and foundations and things promoting this. It really stretches to environmentalism, to energy conservation, all those areas. I saw actually a tweet from the Clinton Library where they had an old video of Bill Clinton riding a bike through the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, it looked like. So people putting up pictures of, you know, Albert Einstein riding his bicycle. So we're seeing a lot of that kind of advocacy today.
Okay. Unfortunately, here in Washington, it's a nice day and good weather. So
yes, good
weather.
Good, for that. Good day for a bike ride.
Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top stories trending. Heavy gunfire is heard as Baghdad protesters surge toward the Green Zone. A Paris attack suspect refuses to speak in court. Zika infects 279 pregnant women in the United States and its territories, and April temperatures break previous monthly heat records. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. China has warned Taiwan against pursuing independence just hours after the island's first female president was sworn into office Friday. Tsai Ing-wen called for positive dialogue with China in her inauguration speech in Taipei. Tsai's pro-independence Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP, won landslide presidential and parliamentary elections earlier this year. The party triumphed over the Nationalist Party, or KMT, which has spent the last 8 years developing ties with Beijing. I spoke with Zheng Wang, director and associate professor at the Center for Peace and Conflict Studies at Seton Hall University.
Tsai Ing-wen's presidency will surely bring a major challenge to the cross-strait relationship, not only because that her party, the DPP, is a party striving for Taiwanese independence, but also Tsai herself is also a politician with long-term, with a strong vision of promoting independence for Taiwan. So for her, it's her belief, it's her strong ideology. So I think many people have this kind of prediction that his presidency will be have a lot of challenges to the current cross-strait relationship, because that in the past 8 years, the former President Ma, he actually, like some people comment, he's the last maybe Taiwanese president with kind of like one China vision or one China identity. So during his term, that he tried to maintain a peaceful and stable relationship with mainland China. But the next 4 years will be rocky for, of course, trade relationship for sure.
In her inaugural speech, Tsai called for positive dialogue with Beijing, but her party, the DPP, was elected over the KMT, which had developed further ties with China. Mm. Is this a contradiction?
Yes. Actually, I think Tsai Ing-wen have worked hard to draft this speech. She probably working on the speech for several months and trying her best to make all the different parties happy, because it's quite difficult speech as she got multiple audience. She wants to make people at China, the leadership in mainland China, kind of like released for the speech. And also she also trying to please American and also people at home, especially her supporters. But it's such a difficult job, and there's a lot of contradictions. For the mainland China, I think the leadership of mainland China is looking for some kind of magic words, what they emphasizing as 1992 consensus, as the key words they want to hear from Tsai Ing-wen's speech. But actually, after we listened to the speech, we know that Tsai Ing-wen didn't provide this magic words. She kind of like working around of it, but not directly mentioned it. And so that I noticed that the Chinese government's Taiwanese Affairs Office is already released announcement, basically is unhappy with her speech and particularly emphasized that she didn't mention this 1992 consensus, which is emphasizing there's only one China. She mentioned something like trying to conduct positive dialogues with China. But for the Chinese side, this principle of 1992 consensus basically is the principle of one China. It's kind of like a foundation for the dialogue, or the precondition for the dialogue. So if Chai refused to agree or to follow up this principle of one China, I don't think China would agree or would be open the door for dialogue directly with her administration. So that is the major contradiction.
Well, as you said, that China issued that statement and warned Taiwan about independence just hours after Tsai was sworn in. Is Beijing seeking to, you know, contain any plans that Tsai and her government may have as they take office?
Yes. I think in her speech, she did mention some plans like to promoting relationship with other countries, and also trying to exploring the economic cooperation with, because currently she mentioned that the Taiwanese economy is heavily relying on the market of mainland China. So she wants to change this situation. But compared with 8 years ago or 16 years ago, when the DPP first came into power as the president, as the ruling party, the balance of power between the mainland China and Taiwan has changed dramatically. So China now has much more resources compared to 8 years ago, 16 years ago. It's much stronger. It's one of the major power in the world. So China now got really a lot of resources to use, and also a lot of means they could use to contain Taiwan.
That's Zheng Wang. He's director and associate professor at the Center for Peace and Conflict Studies at Seton Hall University. Time now to look at financial news, and I'm joined by Jill Malandrino in VOA's New York Bureau. So, Jill, the market has rallied today.
Yeah, you know what? It's actually rallying nicely today after 2 days of some volatility, because the chances for an interest rate hike in June have substantially moved higher following the FOMC minutes that were released on Wednesday. Essentially, there's been a bunch of Fed speakers making the rounds saying that June is a very live, in quotes, time that they could raise interest rates. And despite the 2 days that we saw of a sell-off, I wouldn't even quite call it a contracted sell-off. I think it was more sector rotation that the equity market experienced. Most of the moves happened in the bond market because it's more tied to interest rates. But I think over the next 6 weeks or so as we get through the next FOMC meeting the third week in June, and then, of course, Brexit on June 23rd. Those are two big volatility events that the market has to work through because we're in an absence of earnings right now. And typically when you're in an earnings vacuum, traders and investors, they only look at what's happening on the macro level. And so I think once we get through that, you may see the market settle a bit, assuming that a Brexit doesn't take place. And it, you know, really does depend on what happens with an interest rate hike in June. But in my opinion, I think we should get this interest rate hike out of the way now. That'll get us through the election. And if the market is stable and economic data continues to improve, perhaps we'll see another one at the end of the year or the beginning of 2017. But I think as hawkish as the Fed has been, they have to make a move at this point if data supports it.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Jill. That's Jill Malandrino from VOA's New York Bureau. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that afflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Country music lost one of its great singer-songwriters, Guy Clark. He died after a long illness at the age of 74. Nikki Strong of VOA Music is here to talk of his legacy and impact. Nikki, tell us about Guy Clark.
Well, Guy Clark was many things. He was a prolific singer, songwriter, and musician who did both country and folk music. He also built guitars as well. He was called a songwriter's songwriter, a poet's poet, who wrote many a hit for the who's who in country and Americana music, including Johnny Cash, Emmylou Harris, Alan Jackson, George Strait, to name a few. Roseanne Cash said she would not be the songwriter she was if she hadn't sat at his table and learned from a master. Many called him a king of Texas songwriters. He was one of the great Texas troubadours, and he has the recognition and awards to back that up. He was elected to Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame in 2004. In 2005, the Americana Music Association honored him with a Lifetime Achievement Award. In 2014, he won a Grammy for Best Folk Album for My Favorite Picture of You. And I think this is really cool. In 2011-2012, a slew of country artists, including Willie Nelson, Roseanne Cash, Lyle Lovett, Vince Gill, paid tribute to his work in a Grammy-nominated double album set of songs he wrote or co-wrote, and it was called This One's for Him.
Oh, well, he also substantially contributed to the progressive country and outlaw country genres of music that developed in the 70s.
Yes, Sarah. Now, progressive country came out of songwriters rebelling against mainstream Nashville sound. A lot of these genres are, you know, rebelling against Nashville. For progressive country, it came out of songwriters' desire to write for themselves, as opposed to just, like, churning out hits. They were also influenced by rock music at the time. They were impacted by influential singer-songwriters like Bob Dylan and much of the political discourse of the 1960s. And then progressive country laid the groundwork for outlaw country, which continued to rebel against the commercialization of the Nashville sound and its very clean-cut image at the time. And musically, it drew upon rock and roll as well as honky-tonk and rockabilly. And Guy Clark was very active in both genres.
Even though Guy was a great singer-songwriter, he didn't have the same success as those who recorded his music.
I know, and it's kind of ironic, but not uncommon for that to happen. Guy's recordings of his own songs didn't have the same commercial success. Johnny Cash was one of the first major artists to cover his songs. I know in 1975, he covered the last Gunfighter Ballad. Then later on, Cash did Desperados Waiting for a Train as a member of the country's supergroup, The Highwaymen, which included Willie Nelson, Kris Kristofferson, and Waylon Jennings. And that became a huge hit. And what I find to be funny is he wrote this song called L.A. Freeway, which a lot of artists have covered. It's inspired by the time he spent in L.A. in his early search for fame and fortune before he moved to Nashville. And in the song, he says, if I can just get off this L.A. freeway without getting killed or caught. That's like, and he said after the famous O.J. Simpson Bronco chase, it took him years to be able to sing that line without breaking into laughter. You know, talk about singing about truth. And he also joked that he might have won a Grammy sooner, but he kept losing out to Bob Dylan.
Well, it sounds like he had a great sense of humor.
Yeah, and his narrative-rich songwriting, filled with great metaphors and photographic images, really made him one of the most respected singer-songwriters of his generation.
Well, you can hear more music from Guy Clark and other great country singers and songwriters on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong on VOA 1. If you have any comments, suggestions, or even requests, you can reach Nikki on Twitter at @VOA_music or on Facebook at VOA Music. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
You're welcome.
Like desperados waiting for a train. Like desperados waiting for a train. Like desperados waiting for a train. Like desperados waiting for a train.
That is the music of Guy Clark. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One particularly difficult challenge which societies across the globe have in common is corruption. We are fighting a battle, all of us, for our states, our countries, for our nation state, said Secretary of State John Kerry at the recent Global Anti-Corruption Summit hosted by the UK. Corruption writ large is as much an enemy because it destroys nation states as some of the extremists we're fighting or some of the other challenges that we have faced. Corruption is one of the world's greatest challenges. It is an abuse of power at multiple levels in both the public and private sectors, and it affects all of us. It destroys citizens' trust of their governments, undermines economic development, erodes confidence in democratic institutions, and prepares the way for transnational criminal activities. By crippling basic functions of the state, like security and justice, corruption creates a frustration and vacuum that violent extremists eagerly fill with false promises of a better deal. That helps explain how Daesh took root in Iraq and why the Taliban endures in Afghanistan, wrote Secretary of State Kerry in a blog post just before the summit began. Until we prioritize the fight against corruption, these heinous groups will continue to prey on grievances and recruit new followers who feel disempowered, disrespected, and convinced that the traditional system is rigged against them. It is important to note that it takes a lot of courage to stand up against corruption. That's because of the reality that even if many countries are increasing transparency and tightening banking laws, there will likely be at least one or two nations that may try to attract dirty money by maintaining secrecy in monetary transactions and relaxing their banking laws. So it is up to the rest of the world to ensure there is no safe harbor or impunity for corruption anywhere. It is therefore imperative that the global community, government, civil society, private sector, and the media come together to carry forward the momentum built at the summit and take concrete steps to prevent and fight corruption. Corruption is a poison that erodes trust, robs citizens of their money and their future, and stifles economic growth in the places that need it most, wrote Secretary of State Kerry. It is long past time for the international community to treat corruption with the seriousness and attention it deserves.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.